From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, ER's live season opener aired last night, but with two versions, one for the East Coast and one for the West Coast, who got the better opener? Coming up, a review by TV critic David Bianculli, who watched both. Also, with NYPD Blue's season opener next Tuesday, we'll hear from one of its creators, David Milch, one of its consultants, former NYPD homicide detective Bill Clark, and from actor James McDaniel, who plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy. And John Powers reviews The Edge, the new film based on a David Mamet screenplay. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Several earthquakes in central Italy have killed at least 9 people, destroyed hundreds of homes, and damaged priceless artwork and buildings, including the Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi. NPR's Silvia Pagioli reports from Rome.
The mayor of Assisi told state TV that 2 Franciscan friars were killed when part of the vault of the upper chapel of the 13th century basilica collapsed after a strong tremor this morning. Rescue workers were digging through the rubble to find others feared trapped inside. The tremor was measured at 5.6 on the Richter scale and was slightly more powerful than a previous quake that shook the area during the night. The chapel houses the world-famous frescoes depicting the life of St. Francis by Giotto and works by the medieval master Cimabue. The extent of damage to the frescoes is still not known, but it was confirmed that the first tremor did open up cracks in the artwork. The tremors were felt as far east as the Adriatic coast and to the south in the center of Rome. This is Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
So far, more than 1 million acres have burned in Indonesia. The brush and forest fires are spewing smoke and smog throughout the region. Thousands of people have fallen ill. The experts say the health of millions is threatened. Now it appears the dense fog may have caused a plane crash. An Indonesian airliner went down today on the northern tip of Sumatra, where visibility has been hampered by dense smoke. Officials say there were 234 people on board. They fear all may have perished. If that turns out to be the case, it would be the worst plane crash in Indonesian history. The Senate has begun debating legislation to change the way political campaigns are financed. Majority Leader Trent Lott started the discussion, saying that he has serious doubts that any consensus on reform is possible. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The majority leader surprised senators by scheduling the debate, but as the first to speak, made it clear he opposes most proposed changes to the system. Lott began by slamming President Clinton as a bad example and hardly someone who should be calling for reform. Then he accused reformers of trying to limit contributions so that the news media is made powerful in deciding who should be elected. He held up opponent of reform, Republican Mitch McConnell, as a portrait of political courage, and in general made it clear he believes there is no consensus yet in Congress for change.
They deserve the right to talk about their bill, and we deserve the right to point out where the problems are.
Minority Leader Tom Daschle said Lott is wrong in taking a position that the system isn't broken. Not only do I think he is wrong, Daschle said, so do the American people. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News, the Capitol.
On Wall Street this hour, stocks continue on the upswing. The Dow is up 58 points at 79.06 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 1.94 points at 1680.93. You're listening to National Public Radio News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is rallying on a drop in long-term interest rates. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Long-term rates have fallen after the government reported that economic growth in the second quarter wasn't as fast as initially recorded. GDP was revised from a 3.6% growth rate to 3.3%. Investors are also taking encouragement from a rally in the British stock market, which reached record highs after its biggest one-day point gain ever. There's speculation the British government is considering joining a European single currency earlier than previously thought. The most active issue is an initial public offering in Netlink Communications. The phone company founded by Craig McCaw is up more than 30% on its first day. I'm Doug Krisner.
The International Trade Commission voted today to impose hefty anti-dumping duties on imports from Japan of specialized supercomputers. The commission found the U.S. market is being threatened by Japanese competitors NEC and Fujitsu, who are selling their products at less than fair market value in the U.S. The U.S. Agriculture Department reports today it's investigating reports that South Korea found E. coli bacteria in a shipment of frozen beef from the U.S. Officials said they were surprised by the report, saying the beef would have had to pass USDA inspection before entering the export market. And a survey of new civil servants in Japan finds the perfect boss is Genghis Khan. The 13th century warrior was named most often by new employees as the person they thought would be the best supervisor. A spokesman for the National Personnel Authority said many young workers regard him as a man of organization who achieved a united Mongolia. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Last night, the cast of NBC's ER kicked off their new season by performing their first show live twice. They performed it once for East Coast viewers, then did it again 3 hours later for viewers in the West. Our TV critic David Bianculli has satellite dishes with which he could watch both versions, and he did.
In the end, after closely comparing the East and West Coast live performances of NBC's ER, I've reached two very obvious conclusions. One, live TV is a hell of a lot of fun to watch. And two, the only ER cast member who really improvised, the one whose performances in the two live broadcasts were completely different, was the one without any lines of dialogue, the baby. You remember the baby, the one brought into the emergency room by her parents because she'd suffered what looked to be a dog bite on her arm. In the East Coast version, as George Clooney's Dr. Ross examined her, the baby upstaged Clooney and nearly drowned out his dialogue by going for an all-out emotional performance.
I've had Jojo for 9 years.
He's a vicious dog.
He only sounds that way. He's never bitten anyone
before. He hadn't been around children.
Can you give him rest over there? You see who's laying here?
Did you call animal control?
Honey, please, just take a breath.
This was our daughter.
Let's take a look really quick.
Just come. Oh, yeah.
You're supposed to call animal control with bites. Isn't that the law?
Yes, it is.
Anna, can you pull the light over here? I know, sweetheart. Hang on. Now, did you see how the bite happened?
My son, I ran out to get the phone, and the parents of the dog just went for her.
How bad does it look?
It's deep. She's going to need an intravenous antibiotic. Yeah. That's not a canine bite. That's a bite from an immature Homo sapien. That's one who still has his primary incisors.
Todd?
Did you bite your sister?
But in the 3 hours before that scene was repeated for the West Coast, the very young thespian rethought her approach to the role and apparently decided that less was more. This time, you could hear the other actors more clearly, and the baby herself was almost no factor at all.
I've had Jojo for 9 years.
He's a vicious dog.
He only sounds that way. He's never bitten anyone
before. He hasn't
been
around children.
Can you give it a rest over there?
Hi, sweetheart.
He's laying here, behaving
as call animal control.
Honey, please, just take a breath.
Just take a
look. This was our daughter who was bitten. I can't believe you.
Dr. Ross is just going to take a look, okay?
Just going to take a look here, sweetheart, if I can.
With animal bites, you're supposed to call animal control. Isn't that the law?
Yes, it is. Anna, can you pull that light over here for me, please? Thank you.
That hurts.
Sorry.
What the? Now, did you see how this bite happened?
My son did. I'd run out to get the phone, and apparently the dog just went for her.
Mm-hmm. How bad does it look?
Well, it's pretty deep. She's going to need intravenous antibiotics.
Intravenous?
That's not a canine bite.
What?
No, that's a bite from an immature Homo sapien, one that still has his primary incisors.
Todd?
Did you bite your sister?
For my money, her first performance, all lungs and adrenaline, was much more riveting and real, as were Clooney's soothing reactions to her. For those hardcore ER fans planning to swap last night's videotapes like baseball cards, that scene alone makes the East Coast version more valuable than the later one from the West Coast. Other differences between the two shows were more subtle. There were no major screw-ups at all from cast or crew in either hour, but performances did modulate a bit. Laura Innes as Dr. Kerry Weaver delivered the early show's best performance while erupting in anger at the visiting documentary camera crew. In the later version, her big scene, while still strong, lacked the intensity of the earlier one. On the other hand, Anthony Edwards as Dr. Mark Green, who had the sizable burden of closing the show with an emotional monologue, did well the first time, but even better the second. For the West Coast, His words were more charged, his pauses more forceful, and the entire ending more dramatic. But either way, what fun this show was. And what a wonderful total success. It played with a completely different set of rules and higher stakes and delivered a terrific live theatrical performance on national television. The ER crew may have lost a patient or two last night. Twice. But they gained a neat little spot in TV history. No weekly drama series had ever attempted to go live before. And it'll probably be a long time before anyone tries it again.
David Biancooley is TV critic for the New York Daily News. NYPD Blue begins its new season next Tuesday. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring interviews with the co-creator of the show, David Milch, and the show's consultant, Bill Clark. Later, we'll hear a conversation with Jim McDaniel, the actor who plays the role of Lieutenant Fancy. David Milch has written much of the dialogue that's made the show such a hit. Bill Clark helps keep the series believable. He's a former New York City homicide detective who worked on such high-profile cases as the Son of Sam and the Zodiac murders. Many of the stories on NYPD Blue are based on his work. He was still on the force when he began consulting. He retired in 1995 and moved to L.A., where he continues to work on the show. David Milch and Bill Clark also collaborated on a book, True Blue, The Real Stories Behind NYPD Blue. Terry Gross spoke with them in 1995. She asked Detective Clark about interrogating suspects. Often on NYPD Blue during an interrogation, the cop tries to convince the suspect that he's better off without a lawyer.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that annoys me with television, other than our show, is the fact that people seem to think that the lawyer just comes in to kind of referee the interrogation so that nobody lays a hand on him and he's not intimidated. Well, the reality is, if an attorney enters the room, if he allows the suspect to confess, he is then going to be sued for malpractice. So he is not going to allow him to answer any of your questions. So effectively, the interrogation is shut down the minute that he calls for an attorney. So we work very hard to keep him out of there so that we don't shut down what, in most cases, is the single biggest piece of evidence against the guy, which is a confession.
Now, on the show, the cops are always trying to make it seem like it's going to be a better deal for the suspect if he talks to the cops before the lawyer comes.
Yeah, that's the biggest lie we ever tell. I mean, it's most times...
You suspects out there, Bill doesn't mean it.
Yeah. Most times when a guy sits into that interview room, if he doesn't confess, a great deal of time he'll wind up either walking back out a free man or it'll be at trial a big piece of evidence against him if he does. I'll give you an example of something. It's not my favorite subject, but the O.J. Simpson case. I think one of the mistakes that was made in that case was there was so much evidence against O.J. Simpson, physical evidence. I've never seen so much circumstantial evidence in any case. That rather than get the confession, they did a brief 30-minute interview with him and let him go. Now, with all of the so-called inconsistencies and mishandling and anything else that was brought out in trial, if there had been a confession from O.J. Simpson, he would have been convicted. There was no way that the jury could have looked past that. And that's the lesson that a detective learns very early in his career is with a confession, it's easier for you on the stand because they're not going to beat you up as hard because they know there's a confession that they've got to deal with. And to me, that's the single biggest thing I've always worked for.
So what are some of the things that a cop might tell a suspect to get the suspect to not make that phone call to the lawyer?
Well, one of the things is you tell a guy, listen, you know, you're the guy that's going to do the time, not the attorney. He's looking to come in here for money. He doesn't care about your welfare, you know. This is the time to make the deal. It's going to help you. You can explain why you did it, the motives behind it. You know, we know you didn't mean this. It was an accident type thing. And, you know, something had to drive you to commit this act. I had a case very similar to the Simpson case a week or two before that. And a man and woman stabbed brutally. The woman was stabbed about 30 times, the man about 60. Trail of blood leaving the scene. I had the guy in about 3 days later. Excuse me. And I told him, I says, listen, you know, this is a vicious crime here. This is horrible. I says, something had to push you over the edge to do this. You don't want to go in as a crazy man, or just a vicious murderer. Something had to do it. And he explained it away that it was a jealousy thing, and he lost control. He had done a few years in jail, and he realized when he cut the first guy that he had blew it and he was going to go back, and he just lost control and he just stabbed out of frustration. So
it's important to realize that it's so easy to simplify or oversimplify what a detective does during the course of an interrogation as one thing or another thing. There's an element of physical intimidation sometimes, but much more often you have to be sympathetic to the guy. You have to let him know that you understand what moved him and put him in that position. When someone is willing to cross the line the way a murderer has been by the act of committing the murder, you have to realize that the court of justice is not necessarily the thing that he or she is looking for in the course of the interrogation. They want to feel understood. They want to feel supported. There's a whole range of motivations that the detective can look to satisfy and subordinate the suspect's impulse to get someone else in there. If the person feels that the detective is his best ally, or the detective understands him, in the case Billy's talking about when he got the confession from Flowers, afterwards Flowers said he was the nicest guy Bill had ever met. This poor guy wound up dying a few days later of an asthma attack. But he felt that Billy was his best friend at the end of that interview.
You know, this subject comes up in the book that you co-wrote together, True Blue, about NYPD Blue and the stories behind it. That David, you had asked Detective Bill Clark if he actually ever, you know, roughed anybody up to get a confession.
And, yes.
And, Bill, you give a description not of roughing somebody up, but of making the motions just to kind of inspire a certain amount of fear, I guess, in the suspect. You say, you know, you locked the door, took your watch off, and put your ring on the table and said, now we're going to talk about what I'm here for. You took this man's life, and you have to understand what it takes to make you give that up is laying hands on you. I'm going to beat you till you beg to die. Now, would you follow up on that, or is that just a threat to let the person know you're serious?
No, I would think, fortunately, most people growing up in this country have seen so many movies where cops and detectives beat a guy senseless that they, if you just make them think that we're going to get to that point somewhere along the line, it has the same effect as if you beat the head up against the wall for 2 hours. And I'm not some kind of guy that gets any pleasure out of hitting you people, so I that's not my act. But if they feel that if it goes down to the wire, that's one of the options, it's something they think about. I don't think about it that much. I'm playing a game with this guy. I mean, I've done interrogations for 12 hours before a guy confessed.
12 hours in one sitting?
One sitting, one person. I just come in and out of the room. One that I remember was a triple homicide. Guy was in for a rape that if I didn't get a confession, he was going to go in for that rape, and those three homicides never would have been solved. I really wasn't sure he did it up until about the 11th hour.
Bill, how did you keep your concentration during a 12-hour interrogation?
Well, I mean, there were times I'd step out of the room and I'd just clear my head. I mean, it is very, very tiring and at times. And the thing that you're terrified of, and I've had it happen, where you've got a guy and you spend 4 or 5 hours and then you ask some stupid question that you know set it back to ground zero again. You know, you have to be very careful what you say. And
like what? What could be a setback like that?
If you're looking to get a guy to flip on his co-defendants, and you say something about being a rat or something that, I mean, I'm using real bad examples, but I think you get the idea.
It gives
the
wrong emotional connotation to Bill's position.
So something that's going to insult the suspect.
Yeah, what he's right. He's looking to make the guy feel that he's sympathetic towards him. And some. The other thing that Billy will do, and it's something that we haven't been able to do particularly successfully on the show because of the time element is that when Billy goes at a guy, sometimes he'll have only one piece. He'll have a license plate, or he'll have the driver's license, or something, and he may not use it for 6 hours. He'll go at the guy with irrelevancies to exhaust him, or to build up a particular state of emotional receptivity, and then finally, when he uses the piece of evidence he's got, it invokes a whole range of knowledge that Bill has in the guy's mind that Billy doesn't have, and so it's a very delicate emotional framework that he's trying to generate there, and that's one reason why Billy likes to work by himself.
David Milch and Bill Clark are co-executive producers of NYPD Blue. They spoke with Terry Gross in 1995. We'll be back with more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Terry Gross's interview with David Milch and Bill Clark of NYPD Blue.
On NYPD Blue, there's been a lot of relationships within the force. You know, cops dating other cops.
Yes, uh-huh.
And now, of course, Andy Sipowicz is married to the assistant DA, which is related. Bill, how much of this actually went on the force in New York when you were there?
Well, you asked the wrong guy, because I'm just recently got engaged to a girl who was my partner about 10 years ago. But, I mean, it's something that was said before that I guess I didn't go into in enough detail. We spend 8 hours, 10 hours, sometimes 36 hours with your partner, working in a very intense job with dealing with all types of emotions. People have just sustained the greatest loss of their life. They've lost their husband, their wife, their mother, their father, their sister, their brother, the breadwinner of the family. I mean, all of the things that happen to somebody when a homicide happens. And you're dealing with all of those emotions, and this is the person who tries, when you get alone, when you're in the car going from point A to point B, this is the person that you talk to, and hopefully you try to make some kind of semblance of sanity out of the whole thing and feel good enough that you can go on to the next step. And it's bound to make you very, very close with that person. And if that person happens to be a female, it's is a together person who makes you, you know, it's just going to draw you closer together. Or if it's just the opposite, if you can't stand this person, it's going to drive you apart. So, again, in my experience, I've worked with several females, but as I said, one who was my partner, I've just recently got engaged to. So.
Were you romantically involved while you were partners?
No, but there was a certain attraction, there was no doubt about it. But at that point, no, it wouldn't have been the right thing.
Is that a dangerous thing on the job when you feel that emotionally involved with somebody? You know, when that spark is there, even if you haven't acted on it, because your lives are both constantly in jeopardy.
No, but I can remember, we're doing that in one of our episodes this year. You do get overly protective. I mean, this is, you know, you do cop stuff every day, and a guy goes in or a girl goes in to buy drugs or to make purchase of guns or stolen property. And naturally, if you really have heavy emotional feelings about the person or, in fact, in love with, it does become the terror can take charge there for a few minutes. It happened to me one time, I know.
What happened?
This girl who I had these feelings for was going in to purchase some stolen property, and it was a real nothing thing. It was, we had six detectives on the scene, and she was supposed to give a signal when she had made a thing, and it was supposed to be done in front of the house, and she went into the house, and then all of a sudden I started getting anxiety, like what, something must be going wrong. And it was just strictly a question of me overreacting because I had feelings for the girl.
So what'd you do? I mean, did you go in and
no, I didn't.
You just sat there and were nervous, or did you?
The last time I experienced that, I was in Vietnam, and it was at night, it was pitch dark, and I was in an ambush patrol, and I started hearing things, and you get to control your fear, and that's basically what it was. It was just my controlling my fear, but a fear that shouldn't have even been there.
Bill, you retired from the New York City Police as from your job as a detective during the second season of NYPD Blue. While you were still working as a detective and consulting with the series, was there a new degree of, well, almost self-consciousness that entered your work? Would you be reporting on a case and in the back of your mind see it as an episode?
No, I mean, I did my job as I saw it. I never really thought if a case went down while I was doing it that this would be a good episode. No, I...
Billy is not someone who is comfortable with that kind of irony or distance when he's working as a detective. He takes that very, very seriously. And I know from speaking with him about cases that he was working on all during the period when he was still an active detective that... But you know, if you're a good detective, so much of that coincides with being a good storyteller, because what you're trying to do is sort of extrapolate a whole world or a whole personality from pieces of information. And so when Billy would talk about the cases he was working on, he didn't really need to rephrase for my purposes, because just Billy being Billy, and the way I think I say in the book, you know, when Billy would work on cases, you'd watch him get sick over the cases. They would just occupy his whole being, and when a case wasn't going well, he would be miserable and you couldn't talk to him, and so he was like the most beautiful sort of prism for both the case and for a cop reacting to the case.
David Milch, executive producer of NYPD Blue, and Detective Bill Clark, who's now the show's co-executive producer. They spoke with Terry Gross in 1995. More NYPD Blue in the next half hour. This is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on NYPD Blue. We'll hear from actor James McDaniel, who plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy. Also, John Powers reviews the new film, The Edge, which stars Anthony Hopkins and Alec Baldwin. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. James McDaniel plays Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. He's a very decent, ethical lieutenant who backs up his men when they deserve it. An African-American, Fancy is acutely aware of racism, but does his best to keep his emotions in check. Terry Gross spoke with James McDaniel in 1996. She asked him if the character of Arthur Fancy was written specifically for him.
Yeah, and I could really never figure that out, because they said, you're going to be the lieutenant of this squad of detectives. And I was saying, out of all the things that I could be doing, I see myself much more on the street, running around chasing perps, you know. I'm not that old yet, you know. How am I going to live up to that? That's not the way I see myself at all, you know. I mean, when we had started talking about this, I was, you know, it was around the time I was doing 6 Degrees of Separation. I was playing a 21-year-old interloper into a family's life. You know, I was playing a kid. And they wanted me to play this leader of men, and I knew that I was going to be working with Dennis Franz. And, you know, I mean, I want to be a leader, Dennis Franz. So I had to figure out a way to make that work, and I got gradually I got used to the idea.
You had to figure out how to be a convincing authority figure.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how'd you
do it? A lot of thought went in. Well, one of the things that I realized from, you know, my years of being on the stage is if you want somebody to do what you want them to do, the best way to do it is quietly. For example, if someone's making a move to the door and your next line is stop, the best way to do it is to just say stop as quietly as possible so that it's barely audible to the audience. Because that actor has to stop, after all, right? So if you scream, that means that you have to scream in order to make that person hear you. But if you do it very quietly, he's got to turn around. And that connotes power. And that's one of the things that I use on the show, is that he's very confident, and he makes his wishes known by just really never raising his voice. He just says what he wants done. That's one thing. And then I started to reflect on the people in my life that I knew that were authority figures, and I kind of, you know, spiced it with all those influences I've had.
Who are you thinking of, father, grandfather?
My grandfather, definitely. He was that kind of stoic kind of guy that you didn't really know who he was. But he was... I guess when I was a kid, he worked on the railroads, you know, laying tracks. He was a big guy and very, very quiet. He would sit in the chair and watch Ed Sullivan every Sunday. And all the kids knew when they were in the living room not to even cross his sight path, you know. And he would never raise his voice, but you never wanted to see him angry because you knew that there was a volcano under there. But then he would take a pole and some wire and a woman's stockings and make butterfly nets for all the kids and take you to the park when the butterflies were all over the place. And he would just sit there and we'd run around for hours just chasing these butterflies, and he would just talk to us. So we had this gentle side. Every night he would take all the kids, because I saw him on holidays, Christmas and things like that, and he would take all the kids one by one to the bathroom at, like, you know, 12 o'clock at night when he went to bed. You wouldn't even remember it. I have a vague recollection of it because I was always, you know, really drowsy. So he's a very loving man, but in a way he was very distant.
Now, one of the things you give the impression of in NYPD Blue is of always, like, checking your emotions, reining them in. You always get the feeling that there's stuff this character is thinking that he's not showing and he's not talking about. Do you feel the same way about the character? Do you feel like that's your approach to him?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I mean, you know, this is a cognitive thing that I actually, it doesn't just happen. I don't just show up on the set and it happens like magic, you know. It's, you know, I'm acting. The thing that you have to remember when you do something like that is, when you have a secret, you have to really have a secret. Because if you don't have a secret, the audience will know that you don't have a secret. It won't just appear that way because you just don't say anything, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so if there's stuff that you're not revealing, you have to know what it is that you're not revealing.
Exactly.
So what are some of the things that your character knows about his real feelings that he never tells us about?
Well, one of the things with him is that he's got this black thing, and he seethes about, he's definitely a seether. And He sees a certain amount of injustice, and he's dedicated to overcoming that with every fiber of his being. And it drives him. It makes him almost sick sometimes, because he feels as if he can't be wrong. And everybody should be allowed to feel that they can be wrong sometime. Just fly off the handle, say things they don't really mean. But he's so connected to that as a black man. Once he leaves his house, you know, once he puts on his suit, he becomes this other individual. And it's really interesting to me, and it's something that we really haven't gotten into, is I'd like to see him on the other side of that door much more.
At home, you mean?
At home, just in his private life, when he can let that guard down, because you know that's a part of his secret. I know what he does when he lets his guard down.
What does he do?
Oh, lets himself be crazy. He lets his anger come to the surface. He lets his humor come to the surface.
Now, you know how you were talking about your character as having kind of very, very deep and very strong feelings about race in America, but keeping that in check on the job, just keeping that in and just kind of steaming without revealing what he's really thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever been like that yourself on the subject of race?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to a certain extent, it's one of the things that motivates me. It's been a great motivator for me. I'm very fortunate to be a black man, you know? This is going to sound awful, but it, to a certain degree, has kept James McDaniel from being mediocre. I really think it's one of the driving forces behind me to prove that that I can be good, that I can be somebody, and to make the world see, so that other people like myself can kind of feel like they're somebody. I mean, that sounds pretty pompous, I guess, but that's one of the things that drives me. You know, I see double standards all the time, and I can never really understand it. I really won't be happy until people can just walk into the room, and we live in a colorless society, and I feel like we're so, so far away from that. People just need to look at each other and talk to each other, and from making that assessment, decide whether or not they like each other, just based on what they hear, what they believe is in someone else's heart.
There was a great episode of NYPD Blue a while back, in which race was one of the subjects, and Sipowicz had used a racial epithet with someone on a case that he was working, after that person used that word in describing himself. So Sipowicz was accused of being a racist, but he defended himself by saying, well, he used it to describe himself first, and I was just following up on it. And then you and he have a big blow-up over this, and whether he, you know, you're accusing him of behaving poorly on the case, of being unprofessional on the case, and he's basically accusing you of playing the race card. Let me play that scene where you and he have that big encounter.
Okie doke.
Would have been smarter for you to go home when the shift ended. If you're going after me, you bring charges or let Quasi do it. Because I want a chance to answer him in front of somebody besides you.
Yeah, this is about me, Andy. I'm the racist.
I've said that word. I've thought it plenty, but I've never used it on a job till your hump pal put us on that road.
This isn't about a word, Andy, or your impure thoughts. It's about you making this case harder to work.
Not about you being black, huh? Not about giving some back to me?
It's about what I say it's about.
Then say, part of what it's about is watching me sweat.
Well, a hell of a lot went down today, so I'd have to check my notes. But I thought I'd spend some of that time trying to save your sorry ass.
Give me a break.
No, I'm not going to take you out, Andy. I move you out, my white bosses, they send me a little message. They send me another one just like you. But maybe that one can't do the job like you can.
Jeez, thanks a lot, boss.
If you go, it'll be somebody like Quasi, or like that reporter. I've been dealing with white cops like you ever since the academy. I can manage you with my eyes closed. Now maybe you can't handle a black man being your boss.
I can handle it. I've been covering you 3.5 years, except when you get so tied up in your brother crap, you won't let us work the streets. That's when you get yourself in trouble.
Hey, Lou, we got a report of a person shot near the Houston Street Projects. Want me to handle it?
Was it a homicide?
I don't know.
That teenage girl, the eyewitness, isn't she in those projects?
Yeah, I think we got him out, though.
Sylvie was involved there.
Check it out.
You want me to check it out?
Yeah. Sipwood's the handler.
Did this scene and the whole episode lead to discussions about race off camera?
Well, I mean, we discuss race a lot anyway, you know, or we kind of used to, you know, especially me and Dennis, you know, because we come from two very different backgrounds. So, you know, we talk about race. It's a part of our dialogue. I mean, we spend a lot of time together, you know, off the set, you know, we're in the makeup trailer, you know, we're sitting there having lunch sometimes. We're in between shots, you know. It's not the time that it takes to take a take. It's the time between the takes that takes the time. So we're sitting together for a long time. And race comes into the dialogue a lot.
What kind of things do you talk about?
Well, I mean, for example, one of the conversations that Dennis and I had that was so memorable was him saying, what happened with, you know, like kids, you know, especially inner city kids and things like that. And cops, you know, what happened to Officer Friendly? You know, he couldn't understand why, you know, somebody would want to throw a brick at a squad car because they are there to protect us, to serve and protect. And I'm trying to tell him that, you know, maybe that's the way it was where he came from. But a lot of people don't feel that way. A lot of people feel that, they maybe are there to serve and oppress, maybe. And it's just a different point of view. And we go back and forth about that, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You know, one bad apple, you know, argument.
My guest is James McDaniel. He plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James McDaniel. He plays Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. How did you prepare for the role of Lieutenant Fancy when the series was starting? Did you hang out with cops?
Yeah, that's the first thing. Yeah, and that was really interesting, too, when you're trying to fashion a character. Because the first thing you want to do, and, you know, hence the term role models, you know, you want to see the closest person that you could be to that guy. And, you know, Bill Clark, our technical advisor then, who is now one of our supervising producers, was hooking me up with a lot of people who did my job. And the guys were like, you know, hey, Joey, you know, could you run down and give me a cup of coffee? You know, they were all those kind of, you know, kind of bent nose kind of guys. And I could relate to them to a certain degree. But I just couldn't get that thing. I couldn't see me being them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were like father figures and stuff, you know? And I couldn't see me in that role. But I met this one black lieutenant named Gene Albright, who is much older than me. But he helped me out a lot because what it made me realize is what Arthur Fancy could be. That there wasn't like a strict stereotype or a mold that I had to come out of, because this guy had an art degree and he was very literate and he was very different. He had a very, very high kind of nasal voice. He didn't strike me as being extraordinarily manly. And what that does when you see that is it releases you to other possibilities that maybe your imagination hadn't allowed you to accept.
After having played a cop yourself for several years, what do you think of cops now, and particular, you know, police relations in Los Angeles are so racially charged now and have been for many years. Do you find yourself relating to the cops or what?
No, I keep it simple. I relate to people. You know, there's good cops and there's bad cops.
Right.
And, you know, bad cops make bad policy and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get just as exasperated by cops now as I ever did, you know. I mean, you know, I drive an expensive car. It's not unusual for me to be pulled over twice on the way home on any given evening, you know, because my windows are slightly tinted. I mean, we know what that's about. So I, you know, I just take it kind of a person at a time, you know, knowing that it's human nature. There's some good guys and there's some bad guys. There's a real problem out in L.A., I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, when you're pulled over by a cop, I guess you're assuming it's because you're an African-American driving an expensive car. They think that there's something suspicious happening, is that?
Well, it's not specifically that, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's as a cop, you are trained that you're supposed to spot things that are out of the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's what you think you're being trained to do. And in any individual's mind, it may be out of the ordinary that this guy is driving this car. Let's check this out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's not necessarily a racial thing, but there are racial overtones within that observation.
Now, when that happens to you and you're pulled over, do you ever make a point of making sure that the cop knows who you are, what your role is, how paradoxical this whole situation is?
I don't lean on the show. Because
right.
That's just...
Do you know
that
means who
that,
I
that
am?
Gives me, yeah. You know, when those words come out of my mouth,
uh-huh.
That's going to be a big day.
Right.
That's really... I'm going to say, uh-oh, Jim, you're going over to the other side. Things have gotten really bad. You are officially an L.A. jerk. But I do try to make some type of statement
like?
About it. But it's just what we said. You know, I'll make a big deal as to why the stop. You know, the first thing I do is I make sure that my automobile, everything checks out, even though my windows are slightly tinted. But, I mean, everybody's windows are tinted in L.A. You know, you can't drive a car that doesn't have tinted windows. Your upholstery gets ruined, and you're hot all the time, you know. So I got the lightest tint possible. But everything else on my car checks out, and it's like right there, bam, open the glove compartment, boom, it's there. And from that point on, I just start talking to him. I start asking him why he's doing this, and I try to get into his psychology so that when we finally separate, he thinks about it a little bit. It was kind of an unusual experience.
What kind of reactions have you gotten after talking with the cops who pull you over?
Well, L.A. cops are tough because they have this veneer that's very unlike New York cops, whereby they try to act like perfect human beings. Hello, sir. How are you? You know, we're just about to shoot you, but have a nice day. You know, they go through some type of training for that. I don't know what it is. You know, it's like smile and hate you at the same time, you know. New York cop, if they don't like you, you know, they make no bones about it. It's like, I don't like you, buddy, right now, right here. Let's go. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. No, is there anything you've been able to use on NYPD Blue from your experiences, from your encounters with cops who've pulled you over?
Well, you know, if I was a street cop, there definitely would be. My approach would be to play one of those guys because, you know, that goes straight across race lines, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because I've had that experience. That's why I say it's not necessarily a racial thing, because I've had that experience with black cops, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they do that hail fellow well met type behavior just as good as anybody else. So, if I was a street cop, I would probably play one of those guys. You know, I don't like just, you know, regular old heroes. You know, just, you know, Dudley Do Right, here he comes. I would play one of those kind of guys. Try to find the humanity in there someplace.
James McDaniel, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
It really was. I enjoyed that.
James McDaniel talking with Terry Gross in 1996. He plays the role of Lieutenant Arthur Fancy on NYPD Blue. The show begins its new season on Tuesday. Oh. Coming up, a review of the new movie, The Edge. This is Fresh Air. Most action-adventure movies these days take place in urban settings, but there's a strong movie tradition of films shot in the wild, where the hero does battle with nature, such as the new movie The Edge, starring Anthony Hopkins in a screenplay by David Mamet. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
Movie heroes today can be all sorts of things. Brave, sexy, proficient at murder, even saintly in their stupidity, like Forrest Gump. But what they almost never are is smart or well-educated, for Hollywood worries that audiences feel threatened by intelligence. One of the many pleasures of the new adventure film The Edge is that its filmmakers have no such worries. Their hero is unabashedly brainy. In fact, the film's original title was Bookworm. Sir Anthony Hopkins stars as Charles Morse, a quiet, dreamy billionaire who divides his passion between his young wife, played by Elle Macpherson, and his obsessive reading. Ask him anything and he knows the answer. On a trip to the Alaskan wilderness, he begins to suspect that Robert Greene, a swaggering fashion photographer played by Alec Baldwin, plans to kill him for both his wife and his fortune. But when their small plane crashes during a side trip, Morse, Greene, and Greene's assistant must band together to battle the elements. Suddenly, Morse is transformed. He goes from being a diffident dreamer to leading their long, arduous journey back to the lodge where his wife is awaiting. Morse is the one who plots the course, keeps his comrades hopeful, and dishes up life lessons, as in this scene shortly after the plane crash.
I'm afraid we're in for a bit of a walk.
What does that mean?
We're in for a bit of a walk. Now, I once read an interesting book. It said that most people lost in the wilds, they die of shame.
What?
Yeah. See, they die of shame. What did I do wrong? How could I have gotten myself into this? And so they sit there and they die. Because they didn't do the one thing which would have saved their lives.
And what is that, Charles?
Thinking.
The Edge was scripted by the playwright and filmmaker David Mamet, and it's an egghead's pipe dream. Not only does Morse triumph over adversity because he's a bookworm, but he proves himself to be the most manly of the three men. Mamet is, of course, our poet laureate of machismo, and you can almost sense his relief when he finally gets Elle Macpherson's character off screen and he can concentrate on the power games of the three stranded men. There's always been a pretentious side to Mamet's work, and in the final quarter hour, he serves up several implausible twists in an attempt to impart profundity to what's essentially an adventure tale worthy of Boys Live magazine. Luckily, the movie's been directed by New Zealander Lee Tamahori of Once Were Warriors fame. Playing down the highfalutin side of Mamet's script, Tamahori keeps everything anchored in reality, capturing the power struggle between the men, slowly building our sense of dread, then ratcheting up the thrills in the showdown with a man-killing bear in what may be the most exciting scene with a wild animal in movie history. While Tamahori makes the action believable, Hopkins makes us want to believe it. Lately, he spent too much time impersonating historical figures like Nixon and Picasso, so it's good to see him in a role that lets him show off his gift for bracing pop culture malarkey. Hopkins has never looked handsomer than he does in this movie, which lets him show off a charisma that's patriarchal in all the best senses. He may be the only actor in the world who could make us believe that the bottled-up Morse possesses such vast inner resources that not even nature can defeat him, let alone Alec Baldwin. Although The Edge is very enjoyable, I must admit that one thing about it does bug me: its choice of hero. For most of Hollywood history, movie heroes were rebels who went their own way or sassed the boss. Now they are the boss, Mel Gibson's Millionaire in Ransom, Harrison Ford's President in Air Force One, and Hopkins' Super Mogul here. I can only genuflect before the moral courage of the 20th century Fox executives who had to face their employer, the Australian tycoon Rupert Murdoch, and tell him they were financing a movie about a billionaire who isn't simply smarter and more virile than everyone else, but also a nicer guy. Finally, I can just hear Murdoch saying, a movie that people can relate to.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. To close, we'd like to remember the blues and jazz singer Jimmy Witherspoon, who died last week at the age of 74. Here he is singing his version of the Johnny Mercer tune, Travelin' Light.
I'm travelin' light. Because my girl has gone, and from now on, I'm traveling light. She said goodbye. And took my heart away. So from today, I'm traveling light. No one to see. I'm free as a breeze. No one but me.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Malcolm Gladwell on the deadly Spanish influenza virus of 1918. Samples of the virus may soon be excavated from bodies buried in the Arctic permafrost. They could hold the secret to why 20 to 40 million people died. I'm Barbara Bogave. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.